only because man has sinned. So it's the Christian notion of a human schism is the result of sin. That was the approach of Augustine. Okay? And the Jewish approach, as the Rav expresses itself, is natural. It's not the result of any kind of sin, but it's intrinsic to man himself and the creation of man, and we'll come to that in just a moment. Now, in what way is the Jewish notion of dialectic, according to the Rav, different than the Hegelian notion of dialectic? Remember, Hegel was one of the most important continental philosophers of his era, and he had a certain theory of human history that the way that, not just Marx had a theory of history, that the way that society and civilization advance is through thesis, antithesis, and then synthesis, right? That is to say, you have some movement, some counter-movement, and then there's some integration of the two. So thesis, antithesis, followed by synthesis. Whereas in the Jewish notion of dialectic, the Rav argues, what stage does not exist, Yoni? Synthesis, right? The dialectic is never fully resolved. We're meant to exist in a kind of attention. And majesty and humility will be Boaz one application of that tension, where man is meant, from the Jewish perspective, to have two competing and irreconcilable aspects, what he calls majestic man and humble man, if you will, majesty and humility. And the Rav notes, and we'll read the passage inside in just a moment, that each part of the human personality has its own moral gesture. That is to say, it has its own way of expressing a connection to God, both of which are completely legitimate, one of which is not supposed to dominate the other, and each of which expresses itself, as we'll see, in different ways at different times. And this is an extremely important idea, is that one is not meant to resolve this tension between majestic aspects of man and humble aspects of man, but on the contrary, both need to be expressed. So very poetically, the Rav draws this notion from two distinct sources, one of which I think is particularly elegant insofar as it relates to the creation of man himself. If the Rav's argument is that the Jewish notion of the human schism is not the result of sin, but is natural to man, then I think we should all agree, Yaakov, that it's quite elegant that the Rav is able to pin that schism to the story of man's creation itself. So I'm referring to, of course, and Avram will remind us of the Rashi in just a moment, Vayitzer Hashem Elokim es ha'adam afar min ha'adamah. And the Rav quotes two different interpretations of Rashi of afar min ha'adamah to show how the human schism is intrinsic to the creation of man himself. So what's the first interpretation of Rashi? Go ahead, Avram. Which afar was used?
The actual dust of the earth.
So, well, in both places it's the dust of the earth, but...
So what is that? It was like gathered from everywhere?
The Dalid Ruchos Ha'olam. The idea of man as a cosmic figure, as an explorer, as a traveler, as a conqueror, who wishes to embody and to understand and to advance all of civilization. This, of course, corresponds to the majestic dimension of man, Midal and Ruchos Ha'olam. And what's the second Rashi? Afar min ha'adama? Makom ha'mizbeach. From one local place, and not just a local place, but a place that relates to human sacrifice, human surrender, human withdrawal, and the Rav would refer back to Akedas Yitzchak. That, of course, corresponds to humble man. And the Rav spends a lot of time developing this idea that insofar as man is a cosmic conquering figure, there's always the notion of man as a retiring and humble figure as well, who looks to return to his own nachala, to his own portion. And so in this respect, I think it's very elegant that the Rav is able to utilize rabbinic literature that pertains directly to the creation of the human being itself to show that afar min ha'adama, in the very composition of man, this tension exists. On the one hand, midal rucho sa'olam, expansive, conquering man, whose moral gesture is to partner with God in creation of the world, and then humble man who retreats back to a sacrificial place, to a small place. Humble man, each of these have their own moral vector, number one. Source number two, apropos Tu Bishvat, what was the other way that the Rav developed this? Pasuk and Sefer Dvarim, two different ways of reading the same pasuk. Go ahead, Yoni.
Comparison between Adam and Eitz
HaSadeh. Outstanding. Ki ha-Adam Eitz HaSadeh. So, from the perspective of majestic man, this is a rhetorical question. Can a human being be compared to a tree that's immobilized, that will always be in one place? Of course not. A human being goes further. A human being is mobile. A human being looks to conquer not only this world, but to ascend to space itself. So from the perspective of majestic man, you have to put a question mark here. From the perspective of humble man, ki ha-adam, eitz ha-sadeh, is in fact a statement that relates to the localization of man. The fact that man is rooted in a particular place is not necessarily a conqueror, but looks to be rooted in one particular locale. So that was both the biblical and the rabbinic sourcing that the Rav developed in terms of his particular approach to the schism of man and what he calls the dual morality that emerges from that. Boaz, please go ahead.
I was going to answer that.
You wanted
that,
to?
No. I was going to say that the ki adam is like the humble.
Yeah, exactly. So now let's read that passage inside. It's obviously very, very important. We'll establish the passage inside, and then we'll go on to talk about the dual morality. Okay. So from the very beginning of the essay, let's read that entire section. Man is a dialectical being, and inner schism runs through his personality at every level. A volunteer from the congregation, please. Rafi.
Start from man or from this?
Yeah, man, please.
Man is a dialectical being, and inner schism runs through his personality at every level. This schism is not due to man's revolt against his maker, as Christian theology has preached since the days of Augustine. Unlike this view, according to which it was man who, by his sinful rebellion against his maker, precipitated the split in human nature, the Judaic view posits that the schism is willed by God as the source of man's greatness and his election as a singular charismatic being. Man is a great and creative being because he is torn by conflict and is always in a state of ontological tenseness and perplexity.
Ontological means relating to his existence and itself.
The fact that the creative gesture is associated with agony is a result of his contradiction, which pervades the whole personality of man.
Okay, so here you have again the distinction between Jewish dialectic and Christian dialectic. Now the distinction between Jewish dialectic and Hegelian dialectic. Okay, go ahead, Rafi.
Judaic dialectic, unlike the Hegelian, is irreconcilable and hence interminable. Judaism accepted a dialectic consisting only of thesis and antithesis. The third Hegelian stage, that of reconciliation, is missing. Conflict is final, almost absolute. Only God knows how to reconcile. We do not. Complete reconciliation is an eschatological vision.
Okay, eschatological means only possible in the Messianic age.
To Hegel, man and his history were just abstract ideas. In the world of abstraction, synthesis is conceivable. To Judaism, man has always been and still is a living reality, or may I say, a tragic living reality. In the world of realities, the harmony of opposites is an impossibility.
Okay, now skipping ahead just to the beginning of the second section, it is obvious, and this is what I've already summarized, but I, again, very much want to root things in the text itself. Okay, just a volunteer. It is obvious that dialectical man, let's read, Avi, go ahead.
It is obvious that a dialectical man cannot be committed to a uniform, homogeneous morality. If man is dialectical, so is his moral gesture. Judaism has indeed formulated such a dialectical morality.
Exactly. So, again, that was the dual moral movement that we discussed, is man can act morally in two different ways, either by attempting to be God's partner in majesty and in kind of conquering the world, Dalad Rucho Shel Olam, Ki Ha'adam Eitzah Sadeh, can man be limited? And sometimes man acts morally through withdrawal, through humility, through surrender, through retreat, in a sacrificial gesture to the Makom HaMizbeach itself. That is the essence of man's dual moral gesture. Now, when the Rav details aspects of majestic man, and then we'll turn to humble man in just a moment, the Rav notes that man can act majestically really at three different levels. Who can enumerate these levels for us? So majestic man has it? The three different levels at which man acts a moral gesture within the purview of majestic man. Yaakov?
Having to do with his intellect.
First, intellectually. Very good. Second, Yoni? Experientially. And finally, Avram? Okay, Ellie? Boaz? Ozzy? With respect to his motility. That is to say the following. Man's moral gesture, when he seeks to be majestic in nature, takes on an insatiable desire to know about everything around him or her. The very premise of basic science, to understand the world. He's not only interested in understanding his backyard, the Rav says, or, you know, where does my property end? You know, that's the extent of my interest, so if it's in my neighbor's property, I'm not interested, but, you know, millions and billions of dollars being spent a year on research of space and the ocean floor. And then the Rav has a great line, but it doesn't merely exhaust itself in that kind of intellectual interest, but man seeks to experience this himself. Humans did not satisfy themselves with sending drones or satellites to, you know, as is appropriate to Book Day this year, to observe Mars, but man yearns to go there himself, whether it's Yuri Gagarin or Neil Armstrong, or whoever, of course, will be, I don't think it will be Mark Watney, but it'll be somebody like that who will be the first man on Mars. Man yearns for that experience itself. People pay millions of dollars to be able to travel to the top of Mount Everest to engage in these kinds of explorations themselves. And then finally, and this is again a reiteration of the point of Ki Ha'adam Eitz HaSadeh, man desires to move about, right? When you talk to people about, this is just my observation, the Rav doesn't say this necessarily in the same language himself, when you talk to people about what they want to do before they die, what's the most common answer that people give?
Travel.
They want to go places. The basic desire is of motility, of being able to expand. This is a very kind of universal and a pervasive element. If you take a look here, this is the end of man's the Rav's presentation of cosmic man. Third, man is cosmic through his mobility. Man is a mobile being. He can easily detach himself from native surroundings and adapt himself to new environments. His adaptability to new conditions transcends that of the plant or the animal. The verse in Deuteronomy, Ki Adam Eitz HaSadeh, contains a rhetorical question. Is man like the tree of the field? Is the tree as mobile as man? Certainly not. Man's greatness and distinctiveness find expression in his ceaseless mobility. The tree is inseparable from the soil. Man can and does move away from home. In short, Cosmic Man is mesmerized by the infinite number of opportunities with which his fantasy presents him. He forgets the simple tragic fact that he is finite and mortal, and that to reach out for infinity and eternity is a foolhardy undertaking, which is, of course, where the other aspect, that of humble man, what he calls origin-conscious man, comes back to the fore. Now, in his description of man as a humble being, man as engaging in a moral gesture that is not about his conquering, but is much more about his surrender, not an accident, by the way, that he draws his dirt from the Makom HaMizbeach, he also gives a number of different expressions of this. Okay, so what were some of the moral gestures made by humble man? This is detailed towards the end of the essay. The moral gestures of humble man as opposed to majestic man. Avram, go ahead. So he speaks about it, you know, I guess the example par excellence is, of course, the Akedah itself. Es bincha, es yechidcha, es rahavta, es yitzchak. To sacrifice that which is most dear. The call to surrender. Man and his moral gesture in this context is through sacrifice. Then, of course, in the carnal realm, particular with respect to sexuality. Man's moral gesture in this realm is not to engage in limitless conquest, a la those powerful people prior to the Mabul. Vayu b'neho him es b'nos ha'adam ki tavos hena vayikhu lahem nashim mikol asher b'acharu, whose licentiousness and sexual gusto knew no bounds whatsoever, but on the contrary, the halachic ethic of surrender, of retreat, of withdrawal in this realm is part of the moral gesture of humble man. Let's read that part of the passage inside. Volunteers? What of the ordinary person? Go ahead, Avi. Is there, for example, a more sensitive area in the lives of two young people, man and woman, than their love relationship? Therefore, go ahead. The principle of self-defeating action must govern the relationship in this area. Sex, if unredeemed, may turn into a brutal, ugly performance which man shares with the beast. Sex, therefore, is in need of redemption. It must be purged of its coarseness and animality. What action do Judaism recommend to man in order to achieve this purpose? The movement of withdrawal and self-defeat. Only in light of this principle can we begin to understand many of the strict halachic rules of separation, the entire basic structure of Hilchos Nida. And then finally, man is called upon to surrender not only in the area of carnis, of the pleasure of the flesh, and not only in the example of Akedah Sitzvah, by sacrificing that is most dear, but what is perhaps, from the Rav's point of view, the greatest act of surrender altogether? Boaz? So, very next paragraph. You guys have to be a little more on top of the reading, okay? Who has it? Ellie? Yes? I'm sorry? This happens to be in my copy, page 39, but you guys should just instinctively know. Not a very long piece. Yoni, you have? So again, this is where intellectual surrender comes up. One can divide the mitzvos into rational performances, mishpatim, but equally chukim. And the very idea of being obligated to follow mitzvos that one's intellect has not fully penetrated is equally an act of surrender. Man as rational being seeks to act in accordance with his own intellect. And the suspension of that intellect, the surrender to God's will, is itself a form of surrender and a moral gesture. And it's the constant tension between the majestic man and the humble man, between the moral gesture of seeking to be a world conqueror, intellectually speaking, and that same man who works 8, 10, 12 hours a day in the laboratory conducting painstaking scientific research, who then has to go get his suit checked for shotneys. Judaism has enjoined man to live with this contradiction. The pathologist at Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, who will rigorously define whether this melanoma is stage 2, 3, or 4, will then have to submit to a shotneys check. Or, if the Torah portion is Parshas Chukas, Dag Zera D'Oraisa Zos Chukas HaTorah, to study the laws of Paraduma without hope of penetrating this most inscrutable area. Intellectual conquest, intellectual surrender. Man whose appetite yearns for exploration of the world to see the white sands of Tahiti and the pale blue oceans of Kauai is the same man who must surrender to the carnal experience of intimacy when the halakha demands it. The tension is unresolved. The schism is natural, but also perpetual. Majesty and humility. One final point in concluding this discussion. The Rav does note that even as the schism is natural, afar min ha'adama, midal ruchos ha'olam on the one hand, and on the other hand, mimakom ha'mizbeach. Even if the schism is natural, and the moral gesture, the dual moral gesture, sometimes we act morally and find God in our majestic personality, sometimes we find God in our humble personality, we can develop one particular correlation, and that is to say, we are more likely to meet God either in majestic or humble form, depending on what. What is the one correlation that the Rav develops here? When do we tend to meet God in majestic setting? When do we tend to meet God in the humble setting? Moments of triumph, he tends to see God and meet God in a majestic phase. Melo chol haaretz kivodo. Mizmor letoda hariu lahashem kol haaretz. One experiencing God in the cosmic sense when one is triumphant. There's this feeling of conquest, and in that conquest, that can, of course, be directed spiritually as well. When one is in a moment of suffering, Shir Hamalos Mima'amakim Prasicha Hashem, one tends to relate to God much more in a phase of ongoing humility. The Rav conjures the image at this point of the Sneh, Beware Ba'esh, that when the Jewish people were suffering, Moshe encountered God in a lowly thorn bush. God can be found either Melo Chol Aretz Kivodo Haru LaHashem Chol Aretz. God can be found in the smallest of places. Man's God consciousness tends to differ depending on whether he himself, that is man himself, is in a triumphant moment of conquest or in a tragic moment of defeat. The Rav feels that that will very often, the emotional state will very often control where the man-God encounter takes place. So to review what we saw, obviously majesty and humility is very important in terms of the substance of the essay, in terms of detailing a dual nature to humanity itself. And that's extremely important. Again, one that the Rav feels is entirely natural, that is never reconciled. In that respect, altogether different from the Christian or Hegelian notion of humanity. But what's more important even than the particular substance of this essay, which is why I like to open the syllabus with this essay, is that it gives us a good introduction to the method of dialectic that we'll be exploring throughout this semester. Dialectic, of course, these two opposing vectors. How many of you have studied physics here? And so you know about vector, where you not only have a magnitude, but a direction as well. And in the clash of those vectors, one has what for our purposes will be a kind of an ideological collision. You have different forces that are at combat with each other. And again, the goal is not to synthesize them, but to experience that tension and to see how both of these elements manifest themselves. We do not relate to God purely as conquerors. We're not, when we get to Lonely Men of Faith, we'll put that in terms of Adam 1. We don't relate to God purely as sacrificial beings who are only too happy to martyr ourselves over and again, a la Akedas Yitzchak. There's some combination of both that we're called upon to experience. And the Jewish perspective has been a very demanding one in that regard, insofar as, again, one can imagine an individual who goes from the pathology laboratory, again, where he acts as an intellectual conqueror, rigorously and precisely defining that which is underneath his microscope, or in today's day and age, that which is then expanded so powerfully from the microscopic to large, clear images on his beautiful advanced computer screen, and to go from that to bowing down, literally prostrating himself in the Aleinu prayer during Modim, man is called upon to experience that dynamic of both majestic and humble interactions with God. Okay, so next week we'll take a look first at, I think what I'll have us do is to have us look at catharsis, and then the Hesped for the Talna Rebbetzin. And then we'll take a look at confrontation the following week. I'd like to read confrontation on two consecutive days. So I may add one essay, so it'll probably be catharsis, and then the Hesped for the Talna Rebbetzin, and then confrontation will be the next three essays that we have an opportunity to look at together.